Good afternoon and welcome to WBAA's monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. If you've ever got a question you'd like to get on the program, please do email that to news@wbaa.org or tweet your questions to @WBAAnews on Twitter. Well, as we talked about a little bit last week, you spent some time in Washington, D.C. talking about the University Innovation Alliance's introduction formally. I wondered what you thought the mood was there. Was it primarily hopeful about what could be accomplished? Was there maybe a tinge of skepticism that these universities, which compete on so many different levels for top quality students, could do all of this sharing that's been talked about? How would you characterize the mood?
There was hope. I would also say determination. The 11 schools that have banded together do share, I think, a resolve to do better ensuring the successful education, graduation of particularly low-income students and first-generation students, and I guess a sense of realism that none of us has really figured it out, that no one is satisfied with their rates of success now, and that if we can learn from each other, we're fully prepared to do it.
How many schools do you think are eventually going to be involved in this? Is it the plan to expand it, or is it the plan to keep it to the core dozen or so that you're starting with?
As far as I know, the thought is to first see if we can walk and see if 11 universities spread across the country can truly learn from each other, can truly produce measurably better outcomes. And I would guess that'll be the system for 2-3 years anyway. Let's hope that it works so well here and at other schools that universities who weren't interested initially will clamor to get in.
So it sounds like you want to do some benchmarking first before you decide, do we want to expand this, do we want to scrap this, et cetera?
Right. The project, and I'll take no credit, we're just an enthusiastic member, but those who organized it up to this point have succeeded in exciting people at the Ford Foundation and Lumina, the Gates Foundation, and each of those entities, you might imagine, has requested that there be some careful measurement and some evidence before we go a whole lot further that what we've done in these first few years worked.
You mentioned those granting agencies, the Lumina Foundation, the Gates Foundation. Those folks have given you $5 million basically in seed capital to get this thing going. Somebody asked me, and I realized I had not asked you, what kind of money does the UIA need to keep going, and will you need additional capital either from granting agencies or from the partner institutions or from some other form to keep doing all of this work you want to do?
As far as I know, they've met their targets for fundraising for this first few years of activity. And obviously it calls on each of the 11 universities to make a commitment, and we have, each of us ourselves. As far as I know now, the most important variable is whether we can really make this work. It won't be limited by the availability of funds.
What does it cost Purdue?
Don't know yet.
Okay. You mentioned the possibility of other universities clamoring to get in later on, and I wondered, how do you actually facilitate that? Because the 11 of you that are starting this are theoretically putting a fair amount of skin in the game. You're giving up data that otherwise would have been sequestered within your own universities, and you're trying to make this big data to try to understand what the trends are. You are taking, therefore, proprietary information, and you're sharing it amongst yourselves. Is the plan to freely give that out to other schools, or could you monetize that in some way to see that this keeps growing and you have future research that's funded by people saying, that's a product I'd really like to get into if I'm another university that's not a part of the consortium?
We're public universities where at least we 11 are fully committed to doing better by low-income students and seeing them succeed at higher rates. So I don't think we have any compunction about sharing anything we know now or more important, things we hope to learn over the next few years with other schools. Now, other schools will have to decide for themselves if they either aren't as interested in this issue as we are or if they continue to want to go it alone, that'll be their choice. But from our angle, the more the better.
So you don't envision this as a money-making venture either for the universities or for the UIA
I don't think there's any such intent, and we certainly at Purdue don't have any such intent.
You're listening to WBAA's Monthly Conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. We'd love to have your questions. You can always email them to news@wbaa.org. Tweet those questions as well to @WBAAnews on Twitter. We've also talked about on this program the Gallup-Purdue Index and all the research that's being done there. Gallup put out some interesting numbers. I think it was last week where they said that the amount of student debt, or indeed the likelihood of student debt, is greater among minority students than it is among their white counterparts. In fact, there's some numbers that say that minority students are almost twice as likely to graduate with debt of some kind than their white counterparts. I wondered, what is Purdue doing, if anything, to try to address that sort of trend? And we should say this is a long-standing trend. This is not something that's new, but in this day and age of analytics, it's something that people are beginning to go, oh, this is a real problem, and now we need new solutions to fix it.
Well, every listener to this program knows how committed we are to affordability here at Purdue, and we will continue to work on that. We'll also work to target our financial aid, as we have, more closely at low-income students and at African-American students. We will also work to make certain that students and their families know what they need to know, think carefully before taking on debt. Let's face it, the government has shoveled untold hundreds of billions of dollars, with good intentions as always, at low-income families, many of whom are African-American. This is another, I think, important, the latest important finding from the Gallup-Purdue work. But like some of the others, it's only startling in its degree, not that there is a larger problem here. So if there's a place anywhere working harder on it than we are, more power to them. But we believe that particularly going forward, this will be a smaller issue with Boilermaker graduates than others. The other thing, Stan, that's very important to remember, it's very clear in our own data. If you graduate from Purdue, it's very unlikely that you will have lingering debt or debt that you can't easily manage. The problem, to the extent our students have it, is when they don't graduate. They do have a debt, and they don't graduate with a high chance of a job that allows them to pay it back. So I'm back to the issue of doing better than we've ever done before to make sure students do progress and graduate. If we can keep the cost down, keep the debt down on the way there, of course, that's a good idea.
And there are some new numbers on that I want to get to in just a moment. Most schools, of course, have scholarships or programs that are aimed at minority or urban students. And let's face it, those students in many cases have a much harder time getting into a college than you or I did. And they have many more barriers, many more hoops to go through. It's interesting that these numbers came out from Gallup at the same time that you guys are inaugurating this UIA, because it seems that they're working at approximately the same purpose, which is how do we address these first generation, these low-income students, many of whom, of course, come from minority backgrounds. Is it fair to say that the UIA and your work with it is going to focus in some portion on helping students from minority backgrounds?
Absolutely. You know, by definition, and as you just explained it, I mean, the definition that the founders enunciated is low income. But regrettably, that still means very disproportionately minorities will be represented in that number. And so if we do become better at retaining, graduating those students, we'll have done something that people have been struggling with all over higher ed at this time.
The other part of that I thought about was there are many students, and this is not a particular problem to Indiana, but it's endemic to the Hoosier State, which is You've got a lot of students who come from rural, agrarian backgrounds, many of whom, frankly, are white. I mean, it's kind of a stereotype, but it's the way it is. And it's a lot of those students would want to come to Purdue because of its strong agricultural programming. Is the other half of the UIA trying to figure out how to deal with people who come from rural backgrounds, people who might have come out of small schools that don't have strong traditions of sending their kids to Research One institutions, something like that?
First, be careful about stereotypes, because young people, and I just met two or three walking over here from smaller towns, have a very wide range of interest these days, hardly confined to agriculture. I think the Alliance focus is on low-income students, regardless of other factors in their background and their the early detection of those who might struggle, and the assembly and better utilization of any tool anybody has devised for helping them over the hard spots.
You mentioned just a second ago that Purdue has put out some new numbers about graduation rates, and it shows that 4- and 6-year graduation rates are both up about 3%, and there's at least a positive trend line towards something that you've been talking about for a long time, which is get people through here on time.
Enormously positive. I think everyone expected improvement, but probably not quite as much as we saw. Now that we're seeing first year retention well over 90%, all these percentages are all time records. Now more to be done, and particularly we're still not to 50%. We're just about to chin ourselves on 50% 4-year graduation. Everybody needs to remember that that's limited to those who entered Purdue in the fall and graduated from Purdue in 4 years. There are other students who entered at a different time, can't count them. There are students who started somewhere else and graduated from Purdue in 4 years and can't count them, and can't count those who started here and graduated elsewhere. So
other people, you're saying, who might have graduated in 4 years but took a different track.
That's right. So when we hear 50%, it doesn't mean that many more students didn't graduate, many of them in 4 years. But we've got room to grow, room and work to do. But yes, these were significant improvements, and it reflects not just good work going on right now, but in the last several years here.
I'm always interested in analytics, and the other stat that caught my eye was not just first-year retention rate, but second-year retention rate. And a lot of times colleges have a problem with that drop-off of students transferring or finding some other way out of the university after they've completed a full year. They figure, hey, we'll stick it out freshman year. And then I know plenty of people who I went to school with who didn't make it to sophomore year for one reason or another. But the second-year retention rate would seem to be that kind of, you know, one standard deviation away from whatever your first generation, your first year retention rate is. And that number might be almost more important, I'm thinking.
You could be right, and it's up dramatically too, well into the 80s. And, to people from earlier generations, the fact that as many as 1 in 3 college students these days transfers and doesn't finish at the school they started with is still hard to contemplate, but that's the case, and it's been that way for a while. It's another reason why one of our primary objectives right now is to reverse the recent drop in transfers accepted to Purdue. A certain number of students are going to decide, oh, this is not the perfect place for me. I'm going to go somewhere else. We would like our, let's call it, balance of trade there to be at least even. And as you and I have discussed before, in the last few years, we've had a 500-plus drop in the number of transfer students who successfully make it into Purdue. We also have been doing zero to help them acclimate. We do a lot now, the best we've ever done probably for freshmen showing up. But we've been thoughtlessly, I guess, doing nothing to help orient those transfer students who come in. They do very well anyway, by the way. But, we need to do better at that. And while we want that first and second year retention rate to be as close to 100 as it can possibly be, for those students whose first experience somewhere else wasn't ideal, If they can meet our standards, we want them in.
You mentioned that transfer rate at a university senate meeting a couple of weeks ago, and you addressed that problem to the senators, and you said, and I'm quoting now, "It appears the word is out. Purdue is just too restrictive," end quote. So what are you doing to change that?
Well, a faculty group worked very quickly when we started seeing this, identifying this problem a few months ago, and came up with some very specific barriers that we know what is turning away a lot of our students. Part of it is not that we won't admit them, but we say you can come, but you got to repeat a lot of courses you've already taken. And we've probably been a little too hubristic maybe about that. No one else can teach this subject the way we do. In a couple of court cases, we are turning away students for lack of a course that wasn't even taught at their university or isn't taught very many other places. So barriers like that. But I will say that the leadership of the Senate, Professor Hart, has been terrific, jumped on this. The provost is all over it and has created very quickly an action program to go right at those specific barriers that the faculty themselves identified. And if we can get some cooperation from our colleges where those barriers are in place, we can probably get this thing headed back where it was just a few years ago. And it's very important that we do so. We are missing out on some students who would be very excellent graduates of this university. And by the way, we're a smaller school and taking in fewer tuition dollars because we don't make it convenient for them to come here.
You have said that you mentioned the hubris of the whole thing, and there were some questions that were posed to you from the senators that might speak to that sort of idea. One person said they had seen numbers that say, well, these people come in with lower GPAs and they don't do quite as well. Another person said, what can we do to make sure that they're getting the rigor at their other universities that they would get in the same course or a similar course here at Purdue? How can we be sure that those two courses are, in fact, analogs of one another? How do you deal with those?
Well, with the facts, first of all, which are that transfer students, they graduate in 4 years at a much higher rate than our incoming freshmen. Now, to some extent, that's to be expected because they only are going to be here two or three, and they already had gotten off to a good start somewhere. But, you know, the facts are that they do about as well as the students we admit. So I think the right answer is to try to make sure we don't have artificial barriers or unjustifiable barriers. Let's try to admit the number of students that we were with success just yesterday, and then monitor. If it turns out that some of these students or students coming from a specific school aren't cutting it here, then we'll change direction. But right now, we're just finding ways to exclude them from Purdue. And as I did say, the word appears to be out because applications are dropping sharply too. So it's not going to be easy to turn around, but I hope we can.
How do you, and I suppose IU would have the same issue, both of your universities accept a lot of people who transfer in from Ivy Tech campuses around the state. How do you make sure that an Ivy Tech basic education course, something that might be just a general studies type thing that all students have to take, how do you make sure that those courses or even indeed the very specialized ones are in fact up to the standards that they would be here?
Well, first of all, there are fewer such students than you might think. And that's not necessarily a good thing. I think we want a community college system that is vibrant. And it's good. It'll be affordable. It'll be a really important way for some students to afford college in the first place. So we want one where the graduates with associate degrees are really ready for what we do here. Again, I think the idea is not to take some fail-safe, super restrictive position on the front end because somebody might come here and not cut it. The better idea would be to accord our colleagues at Ivy Tech or some other schools with some degree of respect. And if their students otherwise look up to the task, bring them in. If they're not succeeding, then we'll know and we can dial the restrictions back a little bit. But right now it's perfectly clear, I think, to everybody who's looked at it, there are hundreds of students who would do well here who are not letting in. All, I guess, to make sure that a few students who might not do well don't come.
This is WBAA's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. Email questions to news@wbaa.org or tweet your questions to @WBAAnews on Twitter. One last question about the Senate meeting as it relates to especially the transfer students. One person said they were worried that the school might be too STEM-centric. And I wondered if you think that's a possibility, especially because President Hart brought up the idea of, well, engineering's about to get these 100 new faculty, and she expressed at least a minor worry that other schools, other colleges, their programs might not get to do the hiring that they want to do because so many of these faculty are seemingly, in her eyes, being channeled toward the engineering programs.
Yeah, well, that's a not to worry. It's an investment we're making in engineering. The growth there will not come at anyone else's expense. Now, we have other programs that are shrinking, not because of engineering, just because there's less student demand than there used to be. And you can bet that we'll be cautious about adding staff or faculty to places where the student demand is declining. But that's a very separate thing. It has nothing to do with the growth of engineering. And in terms of being a strong STEM school, we were put here for that purpose 150 years ago. It is a purpose of incredible national importance and statewide need. And it's something we're very, very good at. So we've made that decision. It's not a new one, only that we are going to continue its emphasis with the growth that's represented in our so-called Purdue Moves programs in engineering and computer science and elsewhere.
You mentioned the declining student demand in some of the programs. Is there a process by which the university looks at that demand and decides whether you even need certain programs if the demand falls below a certain level?
There should be, and our provost is operating one. It has been a long and, I would say, careful to look, to say the least. A few programs have been consolidated, a few for which there literally was zero student interest have been closed. But it needs to go further. Other universities are recognizing this need, and we must also. We really do have to put finite resources where they will do the most good, and where the student interest is clear.
I wanted to address with you the thing I spent my Friday on, which was attending the sentencing of Cody Cousins, the young man who killed another engineering student in January on campus, and I'm sure you followed what went on there. What was your reaction to the 65-year sentence that he received? And I don't know if you read the comments that he made sitting there in the courtroom. What did you think when you read about all that?
I was very saddened and sobered. It's not for me to judge what the judge did, but I was impressed by Dave Bangert's excellent column in the local newspaper, having sat there, as a surrogate for those of us who weren't going to be there. And when he said it was chilling, a chill went through me. It's always with regret that we recognize there is evil in this world, and there are behaviors that cannot be excused and cannot be wished away as, you know, somehow just a matter of some kind of imbalance. And that's why we have and must have brave law enforcement. That's why we must have a criminal justice system that protects society and innocent people from recurrence by such people, and I guess that happened here.
Of course, this was so different than what we saw at Virginia Tech or what you would have seen many years ago, for instance, at what happened at UT Austin. This was one person targeting one other person, and of course the university over the last 8 months or so has improved its security features, has done more training. But it begs the question, is this the kind of thing that you can't actually prevent without seriously infringing on the freedoms enjoyed by the students and the staff? I mean, it was mentioned in the hearing, there was a locked door to this classroom that needed a passcode that only the people in the class would have had. And the young man who did the shooting went to what appear to be enormous, crazy lengths to be able to find this person he wanted to do harm to.
There's no way to get to zero. We learn this in various areas of life where we're out to protect people and minimize risk. And I could name other contexts in which at some point trying to reach the unattainable, absolutely zero risk, does inflict costs that are beyond whatever gain is left. So we're going to do everything we know how to do here. We took very seriously the recommendations of the Public Safety Committee, which had a look at this. There are all kinds of additional locks all over campus now. There are desktop alerts. There's an improvement in the text alert feed, on and on and on. And we'll continue doing that. But in those extremely rare cases, and you just described one, where someone is absolutely determined to commit an evil act, the best precautions in the world may not always prevent it.
One last topic in just our last 60 seconds or so here. One other thing that was interesting to me from the Senate meeting, it occurs to me, was a member of the student government got up and said, we'd love it if the state could subsidize student debt, student loans. You, of course, have put together a couple of budgets in your day. In 30 seconds, is this even feasible?
It happens today, more or less. What some people don't know is Indiana has one of the most expensive and supportive state grant programs in the country. And it's one reason that both IU and Purdue are at the bottom of these lists of net cost, because students who come here get dramatically more aid. Ohio, next door, for instance, has almost none. So Indiana, we should all be proud of this, has always, now for quite some time, invested far more in student financial assistance for higher ed than almost anybody else.
All right. Well, we have unfortunately run out of time, but the good news is I have lots of things to ask you next month on my sheet for here. So thanks so much.
Always like it. I always like being here. Thanks.
This has been WBAA's monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. Find archived programs on our website, WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Have a good day.